one thing that should be a guidepost is that you should be avoiding at all costs an environment where multilingualism is on offer for English dominant children as an enrichment matter. Meanwhile, campuses with 30, 40, 50 plus percent of your students as classified English learners are getting English only.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis. Before we get started with this episode, I wanted to take a moment to thank everyone who has joined us for the first 2 days of our annual Impact Virtual Conference. Over the course of the week of December 4th, we will have run 10 sessions with 17 presenters and almost 3,000 registrants, all for free. Participants come from 50 states and 22 countries around the world, and all of this is thanks to our amazing colleagues in the field, in schools, in research, in universities, everywhere. That is the power of the EL community. It is worth mentioning that every presenter who has joined us to facilitate a session has appeared on this podcast, Highest Aspirations. From Joanna Drebbe just a couple weeks ago, to Tan Nguyen and Beth Skelton, to Martha Hernandez and Shelley Spiegel-Coleman, to Chris Ma, who is an expert on AI in education. These are all people who drop what they're doing to share their knowledge and experience with others, and we really appreciate it. Speaking of community and dropping everything, when we launched Highest Aspirations back in March of 2018, we relied heavily on bringing people in who were willing to take a risk with us. We were excited about the potential of the podcast, but as with every new adventure, we weren't sure where it would lead or if anyone would listen. Almost 5 years later, we know that people do listen, and I'm grateful to bring back the first person who took a risk and joined me to talk about dual language programs. That person was Connor Williams. I had just read an article he wrote for The Atlantic, and I cold called him to see if he'd be willing to be our first guest. He did not hesitate to say yes, not because I sold him on the power of our podcast, but because he believed, and he still does, that we should be taking advantage of every opportunity we have to educate others on what works and what doesn't in multilingual education. I am as grateful for his contributions to the field now as I was then, and I'm also grateful to everyone who listens to this podcast and who contributes to our EL community. Thank you. So as I mentioned, our guest today is Connor Williams. Connor is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, where he writes about education, immigration, early education, school choice, and work-life balance challenges for American families. He is an expert on American educational inequity, English learner students, dual immersion programs, urban education, reform, and the history of progressivism. He was previously a senior researcher in New America's Education Policy Program, a senior researcher in its Early Education Initiative, and the founding director of its Dual Language Learners National Work Group. He has taught post-secondary courses at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and American University. He is a member of the Children's Equity Project and the National Conference of State Legislatures State Policy and Research for Early Education Working Group. He is a jack of all trades. He is a wonderful conversationalist, and we're happy to have him on. He's also a regular columnist at The 74 Million. His work has been published by The New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, Washington Post, The New Republic, Dissent, Commonwealth, The Daily Beast, Vox, Talking Points Memo, and elsewhere. We brought him back on Highest Aspirations to discuss the key features of successful dual language programs, how we make them more equitable, the steps we can take to further progress in the dual language movement, and much more. Thanks as always for listening to Highest Aspirations, and remember that if you missed our Impact sessions this week, you can find them all on our EL community at elevationeducation.com/ELcommunity. For now, enjoy our conversation with Connor P. Williams. Connor Williams, welcome back to Highest Aspirations.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I have to start, and I think I've said this before because you've been on since the first time that you came on, but you were our first guest on Highest Aspirations. It's like 5.5 years since that happened back in 2018. And I can remember when we were starting this thing and not knowing where it was going to go. Now we're like 250 episodes in, reading an article that you had, I think it was in The Atlantic. And I was like, I'm going to reach out to this guy and see if he's interested in coming on. And I had no expectation. You got back to me right away. And we had what I thought was a pretty good conversation, although if I looked back and listened to it again, I'd probably be very critical of myself back then. But I just want to thank you for doing that, first of all, coming on and like really kicking this thing off, saying yes, and really continuing to do that over the last 5.5 years. I look at you as like a person who we don't talk all the time, but when we do, it's as if we just talked a day ago. I hope you feel the same, but thanks so much.
Oh, absolutely. Look, and that article has been, at the time, it was something I was seeing up close in my kid's school and in Washington, D.C. It's become this a professional obsession. I tell people about this now. I present on this pretty often, and I show a picture, a screenshot, you know, of the headline and at the Atlantic. And I was really proud of that. And then there's a next slide where it shows it was the number one most read thing on the Atlantic's website in December 2017 for a couple of days after I wrote it. And then I say, you got to remember, like, this is during a moment in the United States where fresh hell was on the news every day. It was like,
yeah,
some guy lied to the FBI, or there's, you know, something about Stormy Daniels in the news. And like, somehow everybody wanted to read about gentrification of dual language programs. And I was just so genuinely blown away by what that article did and what it's meant. So the last 5.5 years, to a degree, have just been me like cashing it out, like going back to that well, trying to figure out how we, how do I make it more than just an article? How do we do something about this?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is why we keep coming back to you and come back to the topic. And so in many ways, we're going to kind of revisit that conversation that we had, but hopefully give it a fresh take. And I think, honestly, it's a really good time to do it. So let's dive in, thinking about that as like our foundation. And by the way, we'll link to that episode in case anybody wants to go back in time and listen to that. So dual language immersion programs continue to become increasingly popular in a wide range of communities. So, you know, you had a take back then, but what's your take now on why folks love them so much? And of course, what are some of the unique benefits they have for our English learners?
Yeah. Well, one thing I'm going to do is just like weasel around the question a little. Just say that, right? I mean, they're increasingly popular in diverse communities for diverse reasons, and I'll get into that in a minute. Some of this is style, and some of it is substance. The style part of it is that, you know, the caricature of myself and frankly the tribe of people that lives around me in D.C. is, you know, a lot of hybrid or electric vehicle driving, New Yorker reading, highly overeducated, upper middle class, often white, generally reasonably well-to-do families. Maybe they read it all in the New Yorker at some point. Maybe they all read my Atlantic piece. I don't care. But at some point, it got fashionable amongst that tribe. Multilingualism became, I don't say a fad, because frankly, a lot of us, myself included, are multilingual. But it became clear that that was a thing you could expect from your school, kid's school, public or private, and that was really cool if you had it. It was the thing you could tour around with you at the birthday circuit or on the playgrounds. Like, well, my kid's in dual language immersion.
Yeah, yep.
It's a very frou-frou sort of thing. And then, you know, the New York Times did their thing, right? Nice White Parents, where that it, like, just not just sort of came out, but it was sort of exploded out of that podcast, just the way that my tribe thinks about these programs. And simultaneously, other communities around the country, I think most notably and most importantly, because of the demographics of the country, right, in Latino communities of a wide range of socioeconomic backgrounds and a wide range of linguistic backgrounds, dual language immersion programs are popular because these represent a chance for their students to maintain part of their heritage linguistically and culturally, to deepen and grow the bilingualism that often they're bringing to schools.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of style to it, right? Like, as a brand, dual language offers a lot to a lot of different communities that lots of, I would say them, but let's say us, lots of we, the parents of the United States, find interesting. There's substance behind that. And this is actually, I don't want to say it's a danger, but one of the things that's most interesting about the way dual language immersion exists in our school system now is there really is a lot of pretty good research showing, lo and behold, those programs are the best way for English learning students, for ELs, to succeed academically, to maintain their emerging bilingual skills. And I think somewhat counterintuitively, but repeatedly in the studies, it's the best way for them to acquire English fully and entirely over time. So that's to say that the appeal of these programs can be sort of faddish and stylish, but it's real. I mean, a lot of it really does deliver.
You know what I kept thinking about when you were talking, and this may be just me, like, so just so everybody knows, it's the day before Thanksgiving here and we're talking, and I just said this is my last sort of obligation before I go out for Thanksgiving. So it could be just them being a little punchy right now or thinking a little about food, but I'm thinking about paella. Do you know why I'm thinking about paella?
I'm regularly thinking about paella. I was thinking about paella 10 minutes ago. It's all I think about most of the days.
Paella was a food like many foods. You know, and there's the Italian example with the pasta puttanesca or whatever, where you just create a dish because it's what you have available to you. And it's this beautiful sort of peasant food. I'm doing in quotes right now. And it's so good for the people that are eating it because they can use what they want and they're nourished and happy. But then somehow those foods became like super fashionable, and you go into a restaurant and you're willing to pay whatever you can pay for it. And by you, I mean the people that you're describing in these well-to-do communities. And so that's why I'm thinking about paella. I don't know if that tracks with you or if we should just cut this out of the interview completely, but that's all I could think about as you were speaking.
Yeah. One of the things that I don't want to go too deep into the weeds, but one thing that's fascinating in the dual language immersion research and advocacy community is you will hear sometimes people allude to hierarchies within the multilingualism world. And the funny thing is who puts which languages where. So there's a definite imprimatur on French bilingualism with English as a sort of elite tier thing to pick up, that mm-hmm. is seen by many people as the kind of bilingualism that outranks other ones. And oftentimes the people who are saying that, they say, oh, all of these gentrifiers, they all want French for their kid, but they don't value the Spanish of the rest of the community. When you talk to the New Yorker Prius set that I was describing earlier, that isn't actually always what I hear. I think that there's a degree to which, maybe this is just that I live in a big blue progressive city in Washington, D.C., you know, Spanish English bilingualism, I think, is because of the degree to which it's highly functional in the United States, culturally, economically, socially, culinary wise. I think it's prestiged above some of these other bilingualisms too. And that's just to say, back to what you were saying about paella, is that there's all of these different ways that different communities view different languages.
Yeah.
And that we haven't even talked about some of the, frankly, the more exotic ones. Like I married a Welsh lady, of all things, who's a native Welsh speaker. We're talking very, very hipster multilingualism in my house, where we're developing potentially trilingual children who are Spanish, English, and Welsh speakers. You can't get anyone out there who hears this podcast who thinks they can top that. If you've got like a Hungarian, Arabic, Mandarin speaker or something, like, get at me, because The point is that the different forms of multilingualism, I think, are a way to get at this paella question too. Why are you learning the languages? What is it for? Is it to validate the study abroad experience you had where you got most of the way, but you know if your kid starts at 5 years old on their bilingualism that they will get it deeper and more authentically? Is it so that your spring break trips are more fancy and more authentic? Is it so that your kid can work in a boardroom someday in another country? Like, what is it you're going for? And you don't actually need to know, because at the end of the day, your kid will go off and live whatever life they live. But it does. Yeah, I think a lot about how, maybe the other way to get, the last thing I'll say about this is that bilingualism exists as a form of diversity, a linguistic diversity that intersects with ethnicity, with socioeconomic status, with education levels, with all kinds of other diversities that produce inequities of opportunity and outcome in U.S. schools and society. And that means that the way that bilingualism looks, a peasant dish, a fisherman dish, an elite global workforce skill, is going to vary a lot by who the person is who's beholding it.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point. I hope nobody is upset that we went down that rabbit hole, but I had to get that paella thing out. But that was really valuable though, because you brought up some things that I think maybe we wouldn't have gotten into had I not mentioned paella, which I am also thinking about frequently as well. And is not on the menu for Thanksgiving, but that's okay. There'll be plenty of time to eat that. All right. So let's kind of, I'm going to try to probably clumsily transition back into what I wanted to ask next, which is the key features. What are the key features of successful dual language immersion programs? And I'm thinking about how they foster supportive environments, particularly for English learners, and promote that cultural understanding among all students, really. So like, if you were to think about those key features, I know it's a simple sort of recipe, but what are they?
I want to be honest here and say that I'm going to give you a couple of things, but it's going to be more theoretical than proven. And that's part, one of the things I think we need to be honest about, really do, in the dual language immersion community, is that we have lots of research showing that bilingual and dual language programs outperform English only programs for English learning kids. That's pretty clear. We have some research showing that two-way dual language immersion programs outperform other forms of dual immersion or bilingual education, although that's not nearly as firm yet. What we don't have is the answer to your question, which is, what are the key features that facilitate those specific outcomes? We do have some theories, though, and I think the one that I want to outline is probably true, which is this. A dual language immersion program that is two-way is bilingual instruction happening in two languages to a linguistically integrated class of students who are native speakers of those two languages. That's the sort of baseline definition of two-way dual language immersion. So the example would be, right, if you're having Korean and English instruction, then roughly half of the students in that class are native Korean speakers and the other half are native English speakers. The key feature probably, and I think we know this, is that way there's academic bilingualism happening. There's academic instruction happening in multiple languages, and there's instruction in each language, the grammar and the syntax and the vocabulary also. And there's the social use of the language, which ends up being key. That's the quote unquote peer effects, right? And if you're familiar with the research on early education, on universal pre-K or on school integration, peer effects are a big deal there. It's a big deal here too, we think. Basically, if you juxtapose that against the way that guys like me learned languages in the United States growing up in the 80s and 90s, it's pretty clear, right? So it's like I started studying Spanish in seventh grade.
Yep, same.
And God bless him, a great teacher. I had a really great, he was a first-year teacher. He was first-year teacher. He was an English dominant, really lovely guy who had minored in Spanish, and he was trying to teach Spanish to a bunch of English dominant seventh graders. And God bless him, he had more Spanish than we did, but man, he was, you know, struggling. He had only kind of gotten there. And that meant that anytime there was a breakdown in the usual language instruction, where mostly it was one person sitting across from another person going, "A mí me gusta fútbol. ¿A ti te gusta el fútbol?" And the other person going, "Sí, sí, a mí me gusta el fútbol." Right, just saying it back and forth. "I like football. Do you like football?" "Yes, I do. I also like football." Anytime there was a breakdown, we didn't solve it in Spanish. We immediately just got back into English and said, okay. And we'd talk about it in English, and then we would try to go back to these like just distilled, repeated formulas. We couldn't use language or Spanish to do anything. We were hopeless. And we had there were no native speakers in the class. It just meant that English was everywhere in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing here. So if you take a one-way dual immersion class, let's just use my Welsh example. Everybody in the class is an English dominant kid, an English dominant student, and you have one native Welsh speaker now as the teacher. And let's say half the day is in Welsh, half the day is in English. They're trying to teach in both languages. If there are no native Welsh speakers amongst the students, it's going to be that way too. You're going to keep defaulting back into English just to get yourself out of trouble. If you have native speakers of Korean and English or Welsh and English in the classroom and the academic instructions coming in both languages, that means that not only is the language of the classroom both Welsh and English or Korean and English, but also the language of the playground is both. And so the goal then is that seems to be what works. We don't know that for sure yet, but I think we're getting there.
Well, let's assume that works, right? Based on what you said, it certainly tracks. And, you said there's some research around it, but let's assume that works. That's a huge challenge, right? I mean, that is the challenge in dual language programs. We're seeing English dominant families that there's a huge desire to be in these programs. And so access and inclusion of English learners is a problem. And then that affects the program. So we talked about this 5 years ago. I can't believe it's been that long. I keep saying that. Are the challenges the same? Have things improved? Are there different challenges? And then I promise people who are listening, we'll get into some potential solutions as well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we know the trend line yet. And partly that's because here at the Century Foundation, where I work, we just put out a big report in the spring of 2023, based on a database of 1,600 schools across 13 to 14 states and the District of Columbia, with over 1 million English learners. And we, the idea was to study who got access to dual language in different communities and to what degree was it changing? So we sort of have that as like a baseline benchmark. Finally, there's at least something like a big national-ish data dump we've tried. And then, you know, we'll be looking back over time and seeing how things change. What I would say is the story we found was more nuanced and varied than we expected. You asked at the beginning about why these are popular in diverse communities, and we found that they are popular in different ways in diverse communities. The example I always come back to is that in Washington, D.C., where I live, the bulk of the dual language programs, about half of the dual language programs are neighborhood schools that are in the school district. Those programs have gentrified oftentimes at the pace of the neighborhoods around them, that as wealthier English dominant families have moved in, those programs have gotten whiter and more English dominant and wealthier. In San Francisco, a city that has also pretty heavily gentrified and has gone a long way, probably even further gentrifying beyond where DC is now, they have dual language programs too, but they're a little bit more rigorous about reserving seats for their native speakers of non-English languages. And so they've seen gentrification as well, but that my read of the data so far is that they have held the line tighter. So it depends. I mean, a lot of it depends. Or Dallas, for instance, has over 60,000 English learners, which just should give you pause. I mean, 60,000 English learners, it's the second most English learner rich district in the country behind Los Angeles. Dallas has more English learners than whole states, right? Just in this one district. Over 40,000 of those students are enrolled in some form of dual language immersion. They basically have met demand with the supply of seats. And that's because the remaining was 18 or 20,000 kids who are English learners who are not in dual language are either opt outs or they've come later as newcomers where dual language isn't nearly as effective. And so in Dallas, the story is that there's more than enough bilingualism to go around. They've done it. The challenge is that Dallas is also a district with essentially very few English dominant privileged children in it. It has, it's sort of a segregated district. It's a product of white flight during the school desegregation efforts. And so on the one hand, yes, they've solved the equitable access to dual language problem for English learners, but you have to be careful celebrating it insofar as that it also represents very much a separate but equal situation where they don't have a gentrifying population around them. And frankly, they don't have the linguistic diversity. They're sort of short on English dominant kids for these programs.
Right. So kind of the opposite problem that we're talking about with these gentrified communities. Let's go back to San Francisco. And you said they've kind of held the line through being rigorous about holding seats for English learners. I mean, I don't know to the extent that you know exactly what they're doing, but it sounds like a model for other districts who are facing similar challenges and making sure that those seats are reserved and that they have that as close as they can to that 50-50 balance. Do you have a sense of what they're doing to sort of hold that line? That's hard to do. And a lot of people would like to know kind of what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, so they have a couple of advantages. One of them is they put these things in place. It looks like from the jump, as far as I'm aware, this has been the structure of how they do dual language. That's a much easier approach than, so in DC, again, where I live, the challenge DC has is that they have been trying sort of to rework how they do enrollment, but it's hard if, let's say, you know, if you're in a dual language neighborhood, a school that has a dual language, or in a neighborhood that has a dual language school, and you, let's say you paid a $1.3 million for a house near that school so that your kid would get access to the dual language program, you are not going to respond super well to changes in the enrollment that might imperil your kid's chance to get in.
You probably have a pretty loud voice.
Yeah. San Francisco, these programs, I believe, as far as I've seen in looking into the history of these programs, has had this in place for a while. And so this is just part of the baseline expectation. The other thing they have going for it is they have a uniquely choice rich school district where there's a lot of there's a lot less neighborhood driven enrollment in schools. So that means that it does make it, I think, systemically more possible to curate linguistically that way, right? You can actually say like, okay, yes, we understand that maybe this school is in a neighborhood that doesn't have the same amount of Spanish speakers as it used to. But if we have enough, because we reserve these seats and there's choice throughout the whole system, Spanish dominant kids from outside the neighborhood have a decent chance of getting in still. And it's part of the sort of citywide expectation that they would be able to get in. Yeah. So that helps.
Built in different, you know, you're not kind of retooling everything and upsetting a lot of people while you do it. The change management piece is not as maybe not even there.
I think that's right.
So thinking about sort of that, the example of San Francisco and Dallas that you gave, and thinking about what you've said about I think you said something like that, the needs of diverse community are diverse, right? Diverse communities are diverse when it comes to dual language. There's no what I take from that is there's really, and this isn't surprising, there's not a formula that you can sort of follow in your specific community and just plug and play. There's not a recipe. But I'm in the sort of spirit of pushing you a little bit. I mean, what are the effective strategies that schools and districts have implemented to kind of ensure equitable access of English learners? I know there's not a formula or strategy, but like, how do you do that? And how do you do that to support the integration of diverse student populations and promote a more inclusive learning environment, particularly for English learners, but really for everybody, because we got to kind of make everybody happy, right? I mean, in order for these to work.
Yeah. There's this one section of the report, and I don't want to actually tell people to read it because, man, it's long. It's long and it's dense. But if you do decide to read this report,
there's also an article that you wrote that talks about the report. It's a little bit easier to. So we'll link to both of those. There are people who are going to want to read the whole thing. Anyway. God.
Yeah. It's called Ensuring Equitable Access to Dual Language Immersion Programs, Supporting English Learners Emerging Bilingualism. And yeah, I'm proud of the title too. But there's this one section near the end, which I was really proud of, because we said, look, we get it. It's really complicated to talk through what equitable access to dual language immersion means in different places, meaning in Dallas, where it's like 40% of the kids are current English learners, and then another 20 or 30% are former English learners. Like, it's a very different conversation than in Washington, D.C., which is a much smaller district, first of all. And second of all, only has, 9 or 10% of the kids are current English learners. It's just a very different context.
Yep.
But what we said is one thing that should be a guidepost is that you should be avoiding at all costs an environment where multilingualism is on offer for English dominant children as an enrichment matter. Meanwhile, campuses with 30, 40, 50 plus percent of your students as classified English learners are getting English only, meaning we want to avoid at all costs the stripping away of multilingualism from non-native speakers of English, while we are also adding multilingualism to native English dominant kids. That's sort of the goal number one. Whatever else, there's lots of room, shades of gray in the middle on like exactly what percentages it needs to be. It's hard to curate, but that feels like one we could all agree on. And so then what can you do about it? Well, one thing is, well, there are civil rights obligations related to linguistic diversity. Mm-hmm. Being a speaker of a particular language is not a civil rights protected class in the same way as race or ethnicity. So I'm sure everyone knows at this point in the United States, you cannot reserve seats for a particular school's enrollment based on race, but you totally can based on language. So again, that's what San Francisco is doing. You can say, look, we basically have two doors into this school. One door is for the native Korean dominant kids, and the other one is for the native English dominant kids. And you can enroll through either of those doors, but we're reserving half of the seats for each door, right? And at one point, San Francisco put out a fascinating document on this where they analyzed the number of applicants for each door in these programs. And it was crazy. You would see it's like 26 kids for every one seat available through the English dominant door in this Korean program I'm thinking of. They were like, five applicants for the Korean dominant door. Mm. Now, some of that is just different. There's just more English dominant kids around. But it does reflect the amount of pressure on each of those sides of the enrollment. So anyway, so you can reserve seats. That's number one. Number two, if you're in a lottery enrollment school, then you can weight your lottery to tilt it so that you sort of lean towards non-native speakers of English. I don't want to make these sound like simple fixes too, because I'm more than a little aware you're going to have to then have some validation, right? Yep. Okay, so you say you're Korean dominant. How are we going to know? You're going to have to come up with a procedure for actually checking these things. But these are solvable problems. I mean, it's there. It could be done. Then, beyond that, there are other like somewhat smaller fixes too. There are transportation policies. You can try to set up the enrollment area for a particular dual language school so that it reflects linguistic diversity, right? I remember hearing once in Portland, Oregon, that they opened a Mandarin immersion program in a historically African-American neighborhood, and they were worried about it conducing to more gentrification in that particular area. So they ended up drawing this enrollment zone, and one, not making it a super high weighting so that out-of-boundary kids would still have a chance of getting in. But two, they drew kind of this gerrymander, to use a negative connotative term, in a positive way, to include an area of the city where there was a number of Chinese origin immigrant communities so that they could then try to build towards linguistic integration between the communities they wanted to serve in a way that was then not increasing the, hopefully, the incentive for privileged, wealthy families to sort of push their way in.
Right.
There's other things. If you're a dual language program and you have a backfill policy, you say, look, we'll let kids in after first grade, but only kids who can prove significant levels of proficiency in our non-English language, right? So that then if, let's say, at 2 or 3 years in, you've lost a bunch of your native Vietnamese speakers, you don't fill their seats with English dominant kids down the line. You fill them with as many Vietnamese speaking kids as you can. And then the last thing, which is actually the biggest thing, but also the hardest thing, is you could just solve the equity crunch entirely. And what I mean by that is we don't have an equity problem in education for any opportunity that is abundant. There is no equity crunch in the United States for access to chairs. We have enough chairs. Not always in any particular classroom, but like most schools have enough chairs. Mm-hmm. We have enough air. There's no equity, maybe not enough clean air, but the idea being when you have enough of something to meet demand, there's not a crunch anymore. So the same thing here. If we grew the number of dual language seats, prioritizing access for English learners, of course, but if we grew the number of seats, then we could actually meet demand and there wouldn't be displacement to the same degree because we'd have enough bilingual education and dual language education classrooms to go around. So the challenge, of course, and I think you know this, is we need a lot more bilingual teachers. That's yep. That's like challenge number one. Now, if you are hearing this right now and you are a classroom teacher in a dual language program, you're like, man, I can't, that's not, I don't get to hire for my district. That's not my thing. I understand. But it is the case that districts and states in particular can do a lot on this. So if you are listening to me and you run your state's credentialing board for teachers, or if you are in the Title III office, get in touch, because there are a lot of things you can do to make it easier for bilingual teacher candidates to make it into the classroom.
And that's exactly where I was going to go. Like predictably, like this, you know, we have limited resources, right? And I was going to ask the question in more of a kind of negative sense. You've given us a little bit of hope, I think, but like, I was thinking about, you know, what are the long-term implications, for dual language programs when we're dealing with already a teacher shortage in general? Teachers are leaving the profession for a variety of reasons and really everywhere. You know, how do we address those issues? And I mean, you brought it up and you gave us some solutions, but I hate to be negative and it's not my kind of go-to, but like we're facing, and also like, you know, ESSER funds are running, there's a perfect storm of like, we have limited resources.
Yeah.
I don't know if I asked you a question. I just kind of like gave you a woeful.
Well, look, I don't want to sidestep the sort of crater in the middle of the field here, you know, or the elephant in the room or whatever you want to call it. I mean, anyone anywhere near public education right now knows that what you say is true. I mean, it is a rough, rough time out there. And my hat is off and my heart is full for everyone who is teaching right now. It's a really challenging time in different ways in different places, but we came out of the pandemic and it felt like, I don't know, I run, right? So you do interval training. And the idea with these workouts usually is you're running a relatively normal jogging pace, and then you speed up for 6 or 8 or 10 minutes or a mile or two. And then the idea is when you stop that speed up period, you go right back to the standard pace before. You don't sort of let yourself slow down. So the pandemic was this period of this like punctuated stress and all of this pressure. And then we didn't come back and like get a break. We came right back and mm-hmm. even keel, go as hard as you can again anyway, even though we'd come through this uniquely traumatic and difficult experience. So let me just sort of just say all that. And I want people to hear that I know it, man. You're not going to hear me give a lecture on schools and teachers need to work harder and need to suffer more and need to just gut it out. I would say a couple of things around the long-term implications, especially around resources for dual language. One, I have not seen this kind of a study done, but I bet we could do it. In the universal pre-K world, you know, universal pre-K is expensive. It's 10 or 20,000 at least a kid, per kid rather, of funding just to get it going. And you know, you got to pay for personnel, what have you. But the argument has always been, if you teach a kid early literacy skills before they get to kindergarten, then they get literacy much better when they're in K and one. And by the time then they get to second and third grade, they read with better comprehension. And lo and behold, they suddenly aren't having to repeat grades very often. And it lowers the percentage of special education placements. And, you know, and then there's some really gaudy stuff. Like when they're 27, they're less likely to have ever gone to prison and their adult incomes are up, all that stuff. And the idea argument is then, right, is that the 20,000 you spent on that kid when they were four,
the huge
saved
investment.
You 80,000 in additional education costs, because it's expensive to pay for third grade twice as the public. It's expensive yep. to put somebody in prison.
And we're largely as a society bought into that.
Would yeah, you say that? I think, well, maybe. Let's see.
It's a universal bit of a trick pre-K. Question.
Universal pre-K is in great shape in some places. It hasn't, yeah, we haven't gone national yet. But I think something like that operates here too, right? We do know that you have a higher percentage of your English learners reclassified and out of the EL group, proficient in English by middle school, if they're in a dual language program. There's some cost savings there, right? That it actually means, you know, you don't have to have as many FTEs for your ESL teachers in middle and high school.
Yeah, and there's, not to interrupt, there's certainly a lot of studies of long-term English learners and their potential or lack thereof moving forward. Very, very similar to the argument you just gave on pre-K. You might have been exactly. going there, but I couldn't resist.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, so if you look at the former English learner group, kids who hit proficiency in English and move on, they appear to be our highest performing students. They mm-hmm. outperform the median American monolingual English dominant student. If you look at our long-term English learners, their dropout rates are like 50% in high yep. school, right? They tend to do much, much worse than our median, you know, monolingual, never English learner student. And so that's just to say that there are some likely cost savings for effectively serving our young English learner students in a dual language program, point one. Point two is, we actually did a different report on bilingual teacher pathways that came out in August that was on this. We've seen some communities where they've built these dual language programs in their K-12 system, and then they're now slowly linking those up to higher ed so that kids who come through these programs then get sometimes like a nudge or some extra resources or even some preferential application treatment to get into the teacher preparation programs to become future dual language teachers back in the district also. So that's the other long-term thing I think about around resources, is that once we get to a critical mass where we have enough dual language programs graduating enough fully bilingual and biliterate graduates, we could start to see that address the bilingual teacher shortage yeah. some. Now that look like, let me just be honest one more time at the end too. We're not honest. Let me be like realistic too. All of those things are real and potential. It is also the case that that isn't going to solve some of the other pressures that are driving people out of the profession. And so while I'm asking for all these other things and dreaming about all the ways things can get better, let me also say that, right, like we should probably figure out a way to boost teacher pay and make the job sustainable in ways that would actually mean that our new crop of bilingual dual language graduates want to become teachers, yeah. not just could become teachers.
Yeah. Boy, I have a lot to say on that. I'm going to refrain, but I just wonder what would happen if all those things happened that you talked about, and we had a pool of students who have come from dual language programs, they're bilingual, they're biliterate, they're excited about helping others, being a part of education. And we said to them, I'll just throw out a number here. You're going to get out of college and you're going to get a job at a school for $100K a year. I mean,
yeah.
It's like, it drives me insane that argument that, and this is beyond my scope of what I normally do on the podcast. So anybody that's listening from Elevation right now, I guess, sorry, I don't know. But like, I mean, I honestly think that that's not the solution, but it would certainly go a long way. And it's somehow it's taboo still to talk about it. I don't understand it. Again, not a question, just a rant. And a
No, I mean, look, like this is, there was an era, beginning of my career, I've been at this 11 years now in the policy world, where there was this reform moment where there was the argument was that there would be a two-prong approach of raising significantly the salary for educators, and then changing the accountability and oversight approach to try to give them, one, more autonomy, two, you know, just like bump them up in the labor market where you're paying salaries that are attracting really excellent, highly ambitious, whatever, you know, the people who are going to go chasing that number. You're going to send a high number at them so that you can pull in some really, really excellent folks. And it's just not happened. I mean, it's completely, it's like you say, this is one of those conversations that just doesn't get off the ground very much. It doesn't feel like we give it a serious airing really ever. I don't know. I mean, the other thing, I guess, when I was talking to teacher candidates, bilingual teacher candidates for that report that we put out, the one in August that I was just mentioning, you could hear it in the way that they talk. They would say, like, well, one of the challenges I have is I have to do a year of unpaid student teaching. That's, I pay tuition to my yep. You know, university while I don't get paid, and I work for free all day. And then at night I work at the local fast food restaurant as a shift manager just to be able to afford to work for free all day. I'm collapsing. I can't. I have two jobs, and that's just for the right to get a job someday, maybe.
And that's a total other end of the spectrum than the spectrum that I'm sort of proposing. You're putting people in a hole and asking themselves to dig themselves out. Nobody's going in there to help them just to get to stable. It's
the only thing I would add is in that district in Georgia, the one that they were student teaching in, one, they had just gotten a federal grant that was going to allow them to start offering stipends to some of these dual language teacher candidates. But also they had gotten approval to offer some signing bonuses at the very least. It was complicated within the collective bargaining. So they couldn't do differential salaries based on your bilingualism or not, but they could at least do a signing bonus that would allow sort of a splash of cash up front for anybody who was willing to join the district. There's probably a there. I mean, and this is one of these things, again, this is outside of my lane too, but this is much older and bigger than the bilingual and dual language teacher shortage, right? That for years we've talked about how, like, in the United States, we don't have a general teacher shortage. We still, even now in this moment, are still producing more trained elementary school teachers than we have spots for them. Hmm. We are not, however, producing enough high school physics teachers, right? We are not producing enough native Mandarin speaking biology teachers to teach middle school dual language biology or what have you. Like, we have specific shortages that are often indexed to specific hard to fill positions. And yet the way we run the teaching profession is that we don't recognize that scarcity as something that probably is going to require differential salary based on the really hard shortages that we have.
Right. Yeah. And that's obviously extremely complicated, which I completely understand. Oh, yeah. I'm not trying to be simplistic about it. I do think there are some relatively simple solutions, although the levers would need to be pulled that I cannot reach, and most of us cannot. All right. So I want to end this with a question about collaboration. The people who listen to this podcast are from a variety of different places. There are certainly content teachers who work with lots of multilingual learners listening. There are dual language teachers. There are administrators. There are probably some people who are in the policymaking world. So if you think about all those people, how can they sort of work to improve the effectiveness and the accessibility of dual language programs, particularly for English learners? I'd ask you two things. What do you see happening now with collaboration, if anything? What's an example of something that you see working well? And the second part of the question is, what is not happening that should be when it comes to collaboration?
Sure. I'm going to give you one that is going to feel empty, but I know everybody can do it. So I want to start there, because every single person, regardless of job right now, regardless of role, regardless of proximity to this issue, can do this. The coolest thing in my professional world that has happened ever, and it's happened in the last year and a half, has been witnessing the Department of Education here in Washington, D.C., adopt an equity-first framing around bilingualism. Meaning, when the Department of Ed talks about, when Secretary Cardona talks about bilingualism, and about dual language programs, they talk about these as a program that is uniquely beneficial for English learners, that is uniquely important for English learners. And sure, with that as a stipulation, works well for all kids and works best when it has a linguistically diverse enrollment, but that it is fundamentally about meeting the unique needs of the emerging bilingual English learning kids. The one thing that anybody can do is keep that framing going. So if you hear somebody talk about multilingualism as part of a global competitive strategy and monolingualism is the illiteracy of the 21st century, those things are true. And they are also of secondary importance to the equity first focus on English learners in these programs. That if I put a fine point on it, like, again, you hear me, I'm from Michigan. I speak English at home. I have been speaking English my whole life. For my children to get Spanish as an additional proficiency language for them, that's enrichment. My kids will be largely fine, probably just as fine as they would have been if they hadn't started picking that language up, if they were just monolingual English speakers or English Welsh bilinguals. They would be fine. It is not essential to them or to their future success that they become proficient in Spanish. It happens to be a thing that they are getting at their schools. It happens to be a wonderful thing. It is not the same level of urgency as making sure that the native Spanish speaking students in our community have access to maintaining their native language while also learning English. This is just not the same project. So anybody out there who's in a school, who's in a district, who's at the state level, who's at any level, anybody who's just a family member or a parent or a caregiver, to talk about dual language as obviously a program that is for the English learner population first, keeping that framing going, building it out so that everybody in the country understands that, that's number one thing we can do.
That's a great point. It seems simple. I haven't heard too many people frame it in a way that is something that people can do. I've heard it. Secretary Cardona is talking about this. It's a talking point. It's out everywhere. Great. Wonderful. But what you just said is important. Perpetuating it, talking about it, advocating for it, educating people about it, just putting it out there, I think is really important. So you said, I think you said it's going to seem simple. Is that what you used, or seem whatever?
Yeah.
But it's effective.
It is. Well, I mean, and then it's not just sort of show up at happy hour and say, hey, guys, I know you wanted to talk about the World Series, but I wanted to tell you about the equity framing of dual language. It's not that. It's more like if you're near a school board meeting, if you're near a district planning meeting and you hear, okay, we're thinking about launching new bilingual classrooms in the district, or we're thinking about making this a dual language school. Some of it's about asking, saying, look, so, okay, great. That sounds wonderful. Like, how do the English learners in our community factor into that? Oh, it's going to be a Japanese immersion school. Do we have any native Japanese speakers in our district? It's going to be, you know, a Welsh immersion school. Why that language? It's about asking these questions and saying, look, like, we have rich linguistic diversity here. Maybe it's Hmong speakers. Maybe it is Vietnamese speakers. Fill in the blank. But making sure that is the beginning phase of the conversation, that's like we talked about in San Francisco, that from the jump, we're building a school and systems that are about serving equity first and linguistic diversity as part of that. So I think that's really powerful. And then if you're in these schools already, if you're in a multilingual settings or multilingual districts, keeping an eye out. One thing I'll just share, which isn't visible to people outside, you know, who see these reports and things we put out, is that every time we put out things around the bilingual teacher shortages or around access to dual language programs, I hear from teachers. Like, I hear from people who say, oh my God, you know, I thought I was the only one. I thought nobody else's community was dealing with this. So that's to say that, one, get in touch if you're in a community where you feel like your dual language program is being colonized and it's no longer prioritizing the native speakers of non-English languages. You know, shoot me a note. My email is williams@tcf. That's T as in the, C as in century, F as in foundation.org. Easily found on the web at TCF as well. And then also keep asking when you see this happening to people in your district, like, are we drifting? Is this what this program was meant to do? Is this mission creep? Are we actually continuing to serve the population that we said we're here to serve? I think that there's a lot of power in that, not least because it's not at the end of the day, I should say this more often. Multilingualism for all is a good goal. It's actually okay. That enrichment part. Like it's great if everybody in this country wanted to learn Welsh. It's excellent if everybody in this country were adding Spanish too, or French or German, or who cares? The problem is ensuring that that desire doesn't get in the way of people who are going to uniquely benefit from bilingualism. Yep. And so when these things are happening, when colonization and gentrification are starting to threaten these programs, it's important to ask these questions in part because usually people aren't seeing it as a bad thing. It's great.
Exactly. That the, it's a really good point.
Local English, the local English dominant community wants in. The challenge is just making sure that their genuine and authentic and okay thing to want isn't a threat to equity.
Yeah. Great. Well, I think that was a great way to wrap this up, Connor. I have two more questions for you, and one you just kind of partially answered. You gave your email, which I will put in the show notes and in the blog post as well that accompanies this episode. Now we'll just let people know that you are someone who responds quickly and you're passionate about this work and you mean it when you say you can reach out. And I would encourage people to do so. I think having sort of the access and the network of schools and the work that you've done in our corner, wherever you are, is really, really important. And this is kind of like one of my personal missions with this podcast is to try to bridge the gap between research and practice and policy and practice, which I think is still, the gap is a little too wide at this point. And you're somebody who I've always respected for also being a part of that work. So reach out if you have questions. But what are some other ways that people can learn about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, this is a harder question than it used to be. You know, it used to say, oh, I'm just on Twitter. And oh my God, what a nightmare. if you search for me on a wide range of the now splintering social media landscape, it's Connor with one N. So Connorp as in Paul Williams. That's my handle at most of these places. But maybe this is the best way is, again, I gave you my email address. Shoot me a note. We run a thing called the English Learners Forum, which is a free open Slack space that teachers who work with English learners or advocates or researchers who care about these kids, where folks can just connect and intersect. And then that forum, the EL forum that we run, again, free, over 800 members, its membership also gets a newsletter that we send out every month now, with things that we've published, things that we're finding, that we're hearing. And so that's probably the best way. And I guess, yeah, let me also just say, this is my chance to say that I am trying to more or less stay off of Twitter. And I endorse that position for all of you who have made that hopefully healthy move for yourselves as well.
Great. Well, we'll link to the Slack group as well as your email, and people can reach out. There's nothing wrong with a good, I guess now, it doesn't seem old fashioned to me, but it is email, which is fine. Reach out to somebody in that way. Last question for you, Connor. What is on your nightstand right now? What are you reading? What's something that's kind of influencing you or having an effect on you either personally or professionally?
Well, yeah, I mean, the nightstand is this really cool book on the origins of English by this guy, John McWhorter, who's a super controversial guy politically, I'm told, but I know him as a linguist, and it's called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold Story of English. And it's all about how English is indebted in its, well, exactly. No, that. So here's a quick example. And I was going to tell you this and then tell you about another book that I was going to recommend instead, but I'm going to just go ahead and stick with this one. So here's a fun example for you. If in Spanish you want to tell somebody that you ate, you just say, you know, comí, I ate, past tense, period. You want to tell them you didn't eat, you say, no comí, I not ate. But in English, something weird happens there. You don't say, I ate, I not ate, you say, I did not eat. Now, what is did doing in there? That verb just came in out of nowhere, has no business being there. And it's in the book, this guy McWhorter calls it meaningless do, the verb to do that's just kind of around, you know? You don't ask, you ate? You say, did you eat? Same thing in the interrogative and in the negative. Why would English have that? And you look around and it's just really rare. It's not a kind of a function of any other languages. And it turns out right there on the British Isles where English was developing, there's this Celtic language too. In fact, there's Cornish and Welsh, which both have exactly this structure in their past tense. Nesi boita, right? I did eat. That's anyway, it's the linguistics of that I'm finding really wonderful. And I've really enjoyed reading more on that, not least because it's, you know, right up next to the kind of work that I do. But let me just give you a somewhat maybe more useful to your readership recommendation. There's a book by a demographer at USC named Dowell Myers, and it's called Immigrants and Boomers. And the reason that I'm recommending it at the end of this is that it's very much in the spirit of how dual language immersion is supposed to work. Boomers are an older cohort, of course, in the United States. As such, they are grayer. That's how it goes when you get old. They are also whiter. The United States was whiter. The sort of cohort of babies in the United States was whiter back then when boomers were being born. The cohorts of babies being born now are not nearly as white as that. We have more children of immigrants and more immigrant kids already in the United States. This demographer writes this book trying to argue for an intergenerational confluence of interest. He's trying to argue why boomers should care about the educational outcomes of young children of immigrants. He says, look, part of this is that you guys are planning on retiring. And he wrote this, you know, now 15, 20 years ago. Somebody's going to have to buy your house as you get done with that house and need the extra money. Somebody's going to have to pay the taxes that make your retirement healthcare available. Somebody's going to have to sort of take on the economy for you. And mm-hmm. he said, given that the cohort of children who are about to be workers that are going to pay for all of this has a lot of immigrants in it, you have every interest in supporting great outcomes for them. And so it's that same thing as dual language immersion, that the diversity of these two generations means that they have a lot of common interest, or at least potentially overlapping interests that could amplify and improve one another's outcomes. If you could read any one thing over the holidays, that's what I'd send you.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. And I love how it gets at it from that kind of like controversial perspective of like something's in it for me, so now I'm going to care. But that's an important perspective to have. We can't ignore that. And I think in education, we often do because we're selfless, right? So that's a really interesting way. And I got to say, the other book's really interesting too. And that did, it made me think about when I was a Spanish teacher, high school Spanish teacher, and, you know, a kid would try to translate, did you eat? And then either use a translation tool or look up one word at a time and they'd say, hiciste comer, right? Which is hacer, the verb to do in Spanish. And it's like, no, that doesn't, but it got me thinking about all the mess. So both those books sound really interesting. And with that, Connor, we talked a lot again, but I enjoyed every minute of it. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sort of going with my rants during this particular episode, and a lot of the curveballs that I threw you. I feel very comfortable doing that with you because you've been on so many times and we've had so many conversations. So much appreciated, and we'll see you next time.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure. And yeah, I could talk about the widest range of education topics with you. It's been just a wonderful time. Happy Thanksgiving to you and to everybody listening.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.